Good morning. Welcome to Scrambled Eggs with Melody this morning instead of Jane. I'm filling in for Jane again, and we're going to have a great program this morning. And I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHIN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I wanted to read a couple of PSAs before we get started with Doreen Hannes. And the third Aspen concert this summer will feature the American Brass Quintet on Saturday, July 23rd at 7:30 p.m. in the John Hell Auditorium in Salida. The world-famous quintet has played here every year since the concert series started in 1976. More information is available from Earl Kittleman at 539-6153. And the Salida Garden Club announces its 2011 Garden Tour on Saturday, July 23rd from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Tickets are available on the day of the tour at the Salida Community Garden located at 2nd and I Streets. There is a small fee. For more information, call 539-9704. And again, this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I hope my guest is hearing me here. Are you there, Doreen?
You're terribly garbled on my end, but I can hear that you're speaking. So.
Okay. Well, if that continues, then I'll just go ahead and call you back on the phone if that's what's happening here. And I'm just wondering if there is something else going on. So that didn't clear up at all then. It hasn't cleared up at all, huh?
No, not really.
All right.
I think it'd probably be best to give it another shot.
I'll just go ahead and call you, and we'll put you up on the phone instead of trying to use Skype here. So we'll go ahead and finish playing the song here and go there.
There's a battle raged on.
Going to try it again. Do we have Doreen?
And I can actually hear you now.
Okay, great. Well, quite often the other works, but you just never know what's going to happen. So,
that's all right. That's what technology is all about, just keeping you on your toes, right?
Yes, and having backup plans. So,
yes.
Okay. I'm going to state that Doreen has been an avid student of the effects of the World Trade Organization free trade agreements on the livelihoods of citizens of the United States since the establishment of the WTO ratification of NAFTA in 94 and 95. Her dominant area of interest has been the impact on independent agriculture and the ramifications of these agreements upon food freedom and consolidation of access to the market for independent growers. And she has been a full-time volunteer advocate for independent agriculture since 2005 and is a well-respected leader in the national movement to halt the National Animal Identification System, now known as ADT, and she's written extensively on the topic of the National Animal Identification System, as well as authored and co-authored several white papers on that and other topics affecting the consolidation of agriculture. She's a regular guest on the Power Hour on the Power Hour. And so I'm going to just stop right there. And and if there's anything more you feel that we need to add on your background, just feel free, Doreen.
You know, basically we're in a fight to be able to eat what we want in our country, and I personally find that to be reprehensible because I don't believe that a people can be free and not have the right to, say, consume raw milk from a dairy of their choice or, you know, make their own stuff and either give it away or trade it with their friends. I think that in order for us to be free, we actually have to be able to eat, too. So, You know, it's the entire issue of agriculture is so overreaching and affects absolutely everyone, and yet there are less than 2% of the population involved directly in agriculture any longer.
And how much did there used to be?
And how much what?
If there's only 2% involved in agriculture now, do you have any idea what it used to be?
It used to, in the 50s, it was close to 25%.
Okay. All right. So there's a lot of issues that come out or branch off from this particular aspect. And one of the things that has come up recently that during this last spring has been what is taking place with the levees on the Mississippi River. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
And you wanted to talk a little bit about that before we go back into the other avenues that are being affected with agriculture.
Well, certainly. Now, I live in Missouri. I live in South Central Missouri, not really near the Bird Point Levee, which is over in southeastern Missouri. And it, when they blew that levee, and this is the Army Corps of Engineers, you have to understand what was actually at stake, and most people probably don't. The levee was about 61 feet tall and 200 to 300 feet wide at the base, and it's about 200 square miles of land that was predominantly agriculture. There were, you know, a couple of little enclaves as far as residences go, things of that nature, and several businesses, actual, usually like large operations that distributed the produce directly to the grocery stores, that kind of thing. Now, Cairo, Illinois, it's spelled Cairo, but around here we call it Cairo, is a very, very small tip of Illinois at the confluence of the Ohio and the Missouri River. At one point, it's just over half a mile wide between the two rivers, and then it broadens out to about three-quarters of a mile wide. This little town had anywhere from 2,600 to 2,800 people in it, and had a wall, like a sea wall, but a river wall, that was actually kind of failing. They'd evacuated the entire town of Cairo, Illinois, and in order to save that town, they said, they needed to blow a two-mile-wide hole in this massive earthen structure, the Bird Point Levee, again, 2 miles wide, 200 to 300 feet wide at the base, 61 feet high, and it blew out this entire thing. They pumped in liquid explosives, a sludge really, and blew up this 2 mile stretch 12 feet down into the ground and let the Mississippi River flood into it. And it destroyed 200 square miles of some of the most productive farmland in the world. And it, when people think about flooding, you know, I've heard this so many times. They say, well, the Nile River flooded, and that's what made that land so fertile. This is not just a slow rising of water that deposits silt. This was 4.1 million gallons of water per second across a two-mile-wide hole blasting across this soil. That is not going to help the soil. And it created these massive ruts, some of them miles long, about 20 feet deep, half a mile wide, looks like miniature Grand Canyon, and this is in the middle of fields, okay? And when they blew that two-mile-wide hole, they, 12 hours later, blew a one-quarter-mile-wide hole south of this, and the water in the river was still very high, so the water fell into that quarter-mile hole, and it created like a tornado of water effect, and it just completely destroyed this 200 square miles of fertile farmland. Now, this is about 100 homes, approximately $85 million for 1 year of crop loss. This land is not going to be able to be used for the most part for, you know, maybe ever. if they can reclaim it. How do you fill in the middle of your field, a hole half a mile wide and 20 feet deep? It's simply not possible, because you would have to basically build a road and then lay topsoil on top of that. And it's just an absolute disaster. And the economic effects of blowing Bird Point levee don't stop at $85 million of crop loss. They carry on. That $85 million crop loss does not cover the structural loss, the infrastructure loss, the roads that were washed out, the electrical lines taken down, the houses that were destroyed, the businesses that were destroyed. All of that is not even included.
One of the things that I thought might bring up on when you're stating that is many of these people that are working this land are living from day to day or season to season, and so when you have some kind of devastation like that, unless the government comes in to help support them on that, they won't be able to weather, you know, that type of devastation, right?
No, they can't weather that kind of devastation. Now, the statements regarding that from the USDA, for those who were on the crop insurance plan, some of them will receive some recompense. Now, like I said, this is $85 million of projected crop loss, not including the irrigation systems, the buildings, whatever equipment, whatever they were unable to get out of their homes. None of that's included. They are not very likely to be able to plant much at all over the course of the next 2 to 3 years. Now, the other issue is that that levee remains open. You know, it hasn't been built back, so we're talking about a hole that's 12 feet now below the level of the land in the area, and it'll just keep flooding until they rebuild this temporary levee. But you can't take crop insurance loss. Now, here's the dynamic on that. You got $85 million in crop loss. Crop insurance would pay about $42 million. Okay, so you're still talking about $43 million worth of loss that they have to absorb. Prior to the destruction of the levee, the amount of money expended by the farmers in that area was $57 million. So that $42 million won't even cover what they'd already put out. So it's kind of like, okay, you need $2,000 a month to live here. I'll give you, $10 and you can spread it up and make it work out. It's not going to. It's not going to allow them to rebuild. And another issue is you have to have some buildings, and you have to have equipment. You have to be able to move that equipment through those fields with these massive craters that are there, and also the wheat crop, which I guess we'll talk about in a little while. You can't even use the equipment that you have.
Okay, now one of the things that comes up on this, and I do want you to also mention your website and contact information, but this is something that was been on planned on the books for quite a while, right?
Well, it's one of the things. It's one of their potential management tools for if the Mississippi River were to go beyond. I'm going from memory here, so bear with me. I think it was 59 feet. If it got above 59 feet, then the general who's in charge of this section of the Mississippi River for the Army Corps of Engineers has the sole authority to determine whether or not they blow levees. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So he reportedly, he labored over the idea and finally said, yes, we're going to blow it. The Missouri governor and the attorney general took it to court, and it went through fast track. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court's decision was the Army Corps of Engineers owns the levee. They can blow it up if they want to.
Okay, now, is there somebody that stands to gain if these farmers start pulling out?
There's a plan that stands to gain if the farmers pull out, and the farmers are pretty much left with, to a large degree, without a choice in the matter.
Okay, and what is that? I mean, is this does this come within the FEMA hazard mitigation?
It's partially that, which is part and parcel of the master plan, which is Agenda 21 Sustainable Development. And Agenda 21 Sustainable Development is a UN program who the – now, this is – I don't know how much have you covered on this.
I'm now – not necessarily on this particular program, but since I do a program on Tuesday nights from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., called Truth Quest on KHN Radio, I have covered this many times on Agenda 21 subjects.
Well, then I'll try and do like the cliff notes, you know.
Okay.
This is a broad brush that I'm going to use here, but Agenda 21 is a UN plan that George Bush Sr. signed on to as part of the Rio Declaration. It's a 400-page UN document. You can go online onto the UN, just Google up or whatever search engine you prefer, UN Agenda 21 text, a PDF, and you can download it and you can read it yourself. It's 400 pages, 40 chapters, covering absolutely every aspect of human life. In the first 10 pages.
But Doreen, that is a condensed version of that particular document.
Right? It's hyper-condensed.
Okay.
But, George Bush signed on to this. The Senate did not ratify it. Bill Clinton established the President's Council on Sustainable Development via Executive Order 12852 when he came into office. What is happening in our country is that although this is not law, it has not passed through the legislative bodies whom the public can hold accountable. It is soft law, and it is going through the administrative side of government without legislative oversight.
And that's a whole other program that I've covered, actually. So go ahead.
Yeah, but this is why all of this insane stuff is happening. Is because, well, maybe not all of it, but it's happening because we are not running under legislative, judicial, and executive branches with oversight throughout. We are now running under administrative law for the most part.
Right, and I've covered that with Ralph Winterrude, who's been pretty extensive in covering this administrative law, although there are other researchers that are involved in putting out that information. So.
Yeah, and I'm unfamiliar with his work, but I have heard his name a few times, so yeah. I need to, I guess, get familiar with him.
Right.
But Agenda 21, within the first 10 pages, of this 400-page UN manual for control of humanity across the globe, it says that its purpose is to control human impact on the environment. That's the purpose of Agenda 21. Now, if you're breathing, you're impacting the environment, folks.
Right.
And in a nutshell, as far as land use and agriculture goes, the plan is to create smart growth cities where you have a buffer zone around the city that is supposed to produce all of the food consumed in the city, and people are supposed to go there, live in these controlled cities, and go ahead and let the land go back to nature. That's the plan in a nutshell. Now, the harsh reality of the situation is this. While you can grow some food around cities, you can't grow enough to feed everybody.
So often, that's why they needed extra areas like the central part of the United States and California, areas that had fertile valleys, to do that kind of production.
Right.
So, but in the meantime, this particular program has a lot of logic to it to a point, but in the meantime, what seems to be happening to the farmers and ranchers is that their lifestyles are being degraded bit by bit by bit.
They're being destroyed, and I mean it's in fell swoops to a large degree. One of the things that people have to understand is that the dynamics of agriculture runs kind of like this. Say for cattle, if you're raising up cattle, there are basically four meatpacking companies in the United States now. So those are the ones who control what you can get for your cattle. And you only have four of them. We have antitrust and anti-monopoly laws in this country that are not enforced. So since they're not enforced, it's a continued progression towards consolidation, where you have fewer and fewer companies offering what people need, okay? Or in the case of being a farmer, you have fewer outlets to sell your product to. So when you only have four meat packers, we've got about 85% of the market consolidated by four meat packers insofar as cattle goes. So 85% is controlled by four, and that is against our laws.
Well, then you throw in the factor that the government's kind of tied at the hip with them, right?
Oh, yeah. They really do need to wear those, you know, sponsored by suits that people talk about sometimes. You know, the corporate sponsor of this legislator is blah, blah, blah. What we have in the agencies, again, which is really probably more important, as I see it, than the legislative body. The legislative bodies can stop this because they control all the money, okay? They can stop it, but they choose not to a large degree because of donations to campaigns, PACs, things of this nature. Now, what happens with our agencies is that we have people appointed to secretaryships and undersecretaryships, and it's just a revolving door between these multinational corporations and these super powerful positions within our administrative body.
Right, right.
So, for instance, Michael Taylor, who's in the FDA, was a vice president of Monsanto.
No conflict of interest there, is there?
Well, there's a definitive conflict of interest, but you know that then we're going to get into all of these other issues about how the FDA approves things to be consumed by human beings, and it's like it's all like recommended by owner stuff. When you see a sleazeball hotel with a big sign that says "recommended by owner," there you go. That's how the FDA approves things. If the corporation has enough money to pull weight, or they have people in position within the agency that can say this is good, then they rubber stamp what is effectively poison for general consumption.
Well, one of the things that I did when I did mention earlier about who stands to gain, now isn't George Soros kind of in the wings here buying up some of this land that is kind of up for grabs now?
Yeah, there's two issues here. There's the Missouri River, which feeds into the Mississippi River, and then the Mississippi River. Now, with Bird Point, that land is most likely going to revert to wetlands because the cost of reconstructing the levee to a height that will actually protect those fields and allow the farmers to, you know, go into further debt to make it productive is going to be very, very cost prohibitive. So Bird Point levee, I think they're just going to let it revert largely to wetlands, which also fulfills the mission of Agenda 21 Sustainable Development. Now, along the Missouri River, there have been offers by the Army Corps of Engineers, as well as two companies that George Soros is behind, to buy up this farmland. Now, it's my understanding, and I don't have firsthand knowledge of this, but it's my understanding that Soros and his two front companies have actually purchased quite a bit of the farmland along the Missouri River already.
Right, and I can't remember the name of the company either because I've seen the...
Step Reese is one of them. But There are two. Now, Soros also recently, within the past 15 months, purchased two of the largest grain elevator companies in the United States.
Okay.
So he's, and George Soros is, he's not a good guy, you know. He's just, he doesn't really have the general public's best interest at heart, in my estimation. He's planning on letting this land revert to the natural waterway of the Missouri River. Now, that's the other issue, is what the Army Corps of Engineers has done with their master water control manual, particularly for the Missouri River. They have all of these reservoirs that are designed to carry the spring melt and flooding, and then they are to release the water from that during the drier season and then let it fill up again the next spring, release it in late summer and early fall. That's not what they've done. Now what they've done is they just let the reservoir hold all that water, keep all that water there. Then when spring melt hits and the river's at its fullest stage, then they let out more water.
Okay, I'm going to just go ahead and say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and I've got Doreen Hannes with me on Scrambled Eggs, and this is Melody filling in for Jane. And Doreen, I would like you to give your website and contact info if you'd like, because you know we're just scratching the surface on this particular issue, and you write about many issues around this. So how can they contact and read your articles?
Okay, well, I have a blog. It's called Truth Farmer. truthfarmer.wordpress.com. I also write for newswithviews.com and libertynewsradio.com. And I'm very active in property rights, private property rights, that is, and agriculture predominantly. And, you know, for listeners' information, the way that I got into this, to the point where I'm doing this more than full time for free, is I
Aren't
went
we
to
all?
A meeting.
Yeah.
Well, I just, you know, I am. I'm like 60.
I know what you mean. No, I'm not saying. I'm saying those of us that are trying to get the information out there, they don't seem to pay us well.
Oh well, you know. No, I'm looking for the eternal reward, I guess. It's just when you go to a meeting and you hear the state veterinarian giving a talk on this new animal identification program that's supposed to be mandatory in your state in January of the next year. I went to a meeting in Ava at the stockyards there in July of 2005. State veterinarian said, this program where you're going to have to put a radio frequency ID into your calves' ears before you can sell them or even buy them in the state of Missouri is going to be mandatory in January 2006. Never gave the name of the program. People were very, very upset. There were close to 500 people there. I stood up and I asked a couple of questions, and then I made a statement. And I said, it sounds like you just want complete control of the food supply. Like, you just want to have complete control of food supply. And he said, we already do.
Whoa. And when you're talking about those IDs, you know, this is down to small fowl and the like, and there's a cost that's involved in putting these things there. So it gets to the point where it's just not economically feasible to even do this, and yet at the same time, they aren't necessarily requiring the same thing on the big the conglomerates, right?
Right. Yeah, the issue, now they've kind of changed their format a little bit. Now they're making the states do it, and it's called Animal Disease Traceability Framework, and they have benchmarks that every state has to meet in particular species, and it's all for traceback. What they want to do is have every type of livestock, all the way from clams to cattle, be traceable via radio frequency ID back to the farm of origin within 24 hours. So the way that NAIS is set up and the way the effect of this is going to be massive consolidation on agriculture. Now, we slowed it down, but the USDA has not changed its plan. It's just changed its implementation of its plan, and it's just going to take them longer to get their desired effect. The way that NAIS is set up is if you had 6 chickens in your backyard and they were all different ages and they raised their own hens or they raised their own replacements, they would each have to be identified. Whereas if you had a 10,000 chicken broiler house, they could all go under one chip.
Wow.
So it had a decided slant towards corporate agriculture inherent in its design, and that's still the case. Because when you talk about the consolidation of the poultry industry, the hog industry, the dairy industry, all of these things have been tremendously consolidated since 1980. In hogs, for instance, we've lost like 85% of hog producers. They just get bigger piles of hogs all in one place instead of being diversified. It's huge concentrated operations.
And yet at the same time, when you do that sort of thing, you have huge environmental impacts that they
right.
seem to be able to work around, right?
Yes, you do have huge environmental impact. And you also end up with, for instance, we just grew up a whole bunch of broilers for ourselves, right? And we feed them out feed that we can get from the feed store, $23 to $24 per 100 pounds. The way that the chicken industry is set up, the farmer builds the chicken house according to the company's specifications. The company provides the birds and provides the feed and supposedly compensates the farmer for their labor. Okay? Well, they can buy the feed instead of 100 pounds at a time. They buy megatons of feed. So they're, and it's usually medicated, so they're feeding them this stuff at like $6 to $7 per hundred, whereas if you're going to do it on your own, you're going to be paying $23, $24 per hundred.
Okay, so...
So it just... What happens with consolidation is that you have a very uneven playing field. It's not like you can have a good idea and be a good business person and be able to break into the market very readily.
Well, okay? One of the things that I'm seeing that's take place, this is across the board, and it isn't just in agriculture, it's in many other aspects of the economy at this point, is that it's though they're consolidating everything
yeah.
and that there's a concession being given out to a specific corporate structure who takes that on, and everybody will be out except for that particular corporation. It's like a concession on a national park. You usually have like one concession that provides all, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
They give that to them. Well, there isn't going to be any kind of free market. They have no intent of that.
Well, it's a totally managed market, and it's kind of like, you know, the Walmartization of America to a large degree.
Right.
And that's happening in every segment of our economy. Now, what you're dealing with in agriculture is that's all the new wealth. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with this, but if you think about it, to generate new wealth, you actually have to create or produce something. And in order to do that, you have to have the ground, because it produces food, it produces ore, it produces oil. So all new wealth comes from the ground, and then from that point, it transfers hands and is processed or further developed to be something that can be used. And when you're controlling the land and you're controlling people's ability to profit from their labor on the land, which has been happening in this country since 1930s, you are then squelching the largest segment of the economy that provides new wealth.
And any kind of independence, in a sense.
Right, because, you know, currently we're importing about 70% of our produce. When you are importing and you can no longer feed yourself as a nation, it is impossible to be free. And it's a matter of national security. We have the capacity, we have the ability, we have the know-how, but we have such market consolidation by these multinational corporations, and they go for the bottom dollar. So you got Tyson, who's opening up chicken farms in Argentina and in Brazil because it's cheaper down there. They just don't have the infrastructure that we have. You've got Tyson as well in China. All of these companies are going for the lowest output because that is what corporations do, especially when the constraints against importation are reduced.
Now,
we have very little in the way of incentive in this country to keep people producing food.
And one of the things that they did in the 30s, I believe, if I'm stating this correctly, is, you know, when they start handing out carrots and supplementing us in they've done it in the agriculture arena for years, but they also do it in many other ways. And one of the terms is grants. We're always looking for grants for this, grants for that. Well, they don't come without strings. And when we start taking those kind of grants, we're giving up our independence and our ability to do what we want to do. So we really need to start looking at that heavily now. I mean, things are moving so fast. But another aspect of this animal thing is we recently had in our newspaper, an article stating, for animal, the animal control has teamed up with Crime Stoppers. And I don't think, I have to wonder if people realize what all the implications are of that. And I've seen what animal control can do to ranchers and farmers. And it isn't that it can't be a good thing, but you get one that's rogue and you're up a creek, right?
Oh, yeah. Now, Denise Amalet, if listeners would like a little bit of education in what happens when HSUS, which is the Humane Society of the United States, is treated as a valid entity that actually knows anything about animals, go look up Denise Mallett, M-A-L-L-O-T. She had 25 horses. This is in Arkansas, actually not too far from me. And she had a deal go bad with a lady that wanted to buy some horses. I can't remember all the particulars of the deal, but it created some enmity between them. HSUS shows up at her place and shows badges and is with the sheriff's department. They took 25 horses away from her because it was muddy in November and moved them and then charged her some reprehensible amount. I want to say it was about $10,000 a month to keep these horses on some other property away from her. And the sheriff in her county thought HSUS was a federal agency.
Well, I did an interview recently with one rancher over in Park County, but in the meantime, preparing for that particular interview, I talked to numerous people who have come under the Humane Society.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and we also got a chance to talk with an ex-animal control officer, and even his comments were to the effect that, you know, things are of a different nature now with this particular department, and it can be used to help incrementally break down those ranchers and farmers that you know, have just a limited amount of funds, and if they have to go to court to prove that they are innocent,
yep.
And I'm even, they were, and Wes McKinley is a representative in this state, has been outspoken on this issue, because they've come in and they've even turned around selling their animals, and they, even if they have proved that, you know, they didn't, you know,
they didn't abuse them.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's extenuating circumstances that take place, and then they tie their hands and then make them unable to have the funds or to get at their funds or to get around their animals to be able to care for them like they're supposed to, but in still requiring them to do so.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, here, swim with bricks tied to your feet and hands.
Right.
Pretty much. And that's, you know, that's pretty much the MO. Now, what your listeners might need to take home with them is that HFUS and PETA have lobbied the USDA and Congress for more funding for the Animal Welfare Act, which, if you sell more than $500 worth of pet animals a year, they have authority over you. And what they're doing now is they're expanding the Animal Welfare Act to include poultry. So what you're talking about is an agency that is in the business of continuing to justify its existence, that makes things against the law by regulation writing. And it isn't, we already have, I don't know of any state that does not have animal cruelty laws on the books. And via statute, there's nothing wrong with halting somebody from actually abusing animals. You know, I'm very much against abusing animals. By the same token, animals do not have more rights than human beings. And when you have an animal, you have responsibilities, but they are also your property.
Well, what these agencies are doing, though, is they're funding themselves by these actions, and
right.
It becomes a revolving door of, you know, they've got to go out and find somebody that's abusing, and it's hard to prove. It's kind of like if your children are taken from you on Child Protective. I've run into many a person that's dealt with that in Child Protective. These agencies are not easy to fight because they don't play fair.
Well, no, and also they get you into administrative court, which is you're not allowed a jury. And it also eats up all of your time. Now, this is a really good example of how the agencies operate. Over here in Nixon, Missouri, which is just south of Springfield, Missouri, it's a family called the Dollar Heights, Dollar Value Rabbitry. They had their son raise rabbits so that he could learn how to manage money and manage a business. They bought the rabbitry from him, and they sold $4,200 worth of pet rabbits within the state of Missouri. APHIS is a division of the USDA, and they are in charge of enforcing the Animal Welfare Act. They sent somebody out and inspected their rabbitry. Well, they're not licensed, they're not certified, and they don't engage in interstate commerce, so they have no authority there. Well, a year later, this family who sold all of its rabbit equipment gets a letter in the mail from the USDA telling them that they owe them a $90,653 fine for selling more than $500 worth of rabbits without a license. Okay? They said, you're crazy, we're not paying it, and hired an attorney. The USDA said if they didn't pay that $90,000 fine, that they were going to be responsible for a $4.1 million fine. And now they've got an attorney. They didn't pay the $90,000. The USDA offered them a stipulative agreement. In that agreement, first thing is, the father, Mr. Dollarhite, John, had to admit that the USDA has jurisdiction, agree to never engage in rearing animals that would be covered by the Animal Welfare Act again, have nothing to do with any enterprise involving animals ever again. A permanent injunction against every animal covered under the AWA, which is everything except for mice and rats.
And I've run into that same issue with people in this state here, that they've been given those provisions, and even though they may even be innocent, they it costs them so much money to the point that sometimes they have to just give up because they can't defend themselves against these. And so this can go down to our dogs and our cats. And,
absolutely.
And so, you know, even though, again, they've been on the books, and people shouldn't be abusing, but at the same time, these agencies have a voracious appetite for costs, particularly if they're going to keep expanding themselves.
Well, right, and they have to continue to justify their existence. And here's the really important thing, is that in the Dollar Height case, there are zero allegations of any type of cruelty or any type of neglect. The only issue is they didn't have a license. However, they weren't engaged in interstate commerce, so they don't fall under the USDA's jurisdiction.
So the biggest job buildup that we've had in this country has been in administrative bureaucracies, and this is you're going to be feeding the beast if we don't start standing up and looking at these agencies, because they are the ones that are paying these people to come out and start, you know, dropping the dime on people for things that, you know, I mean, how do you defend yourself against somebody that doesn't even have to be, I mean, it's anonymous.
Well, right. It's all anonymous. They're anonymous tips. They just come to inspect. When they inspect, they don't have to have a checklist. There's nothing that has to be proven. It's all done on what the inspector thinks. Well, I mean, effectively what we have here is just a modern-day bureaucrat-run witch hunt.
Right.
They have to justify their continued employment, and that's what is happening. Now, the Animal Welfare Act, they split it into, I believe it was two regions within the United States. APHIS oversees that, and the person in charge, the western half, is an animal rights activist. So, you know, you've got basically someone who thinks, if she ascribes to the stated agreements of HSUS and PETA, that people should not own animals, in charge of deciding whether or not somebody is abusing their animals, with no checklist, no proof requirements. You don't need to have a burden of proof. You don't have to have anything. Just an allegation is all that's necessary any longer.
Well, the act that you were talking about the Administrative Act, a lot of people are totally not even aware of this, but this is what is a lot of these bureaucracies are coming under, and we don't, many of us don't have a clue what this is all about, and it's there. I believe it was done in 1947, and these what's taking place has been an agenda that's been there for a long time, at least a century, on some aspects of it. And until we start connecting the dots and start doing a little homework and start asking questions and going to these meetings and start paying attention to all these little incremental things that are starting to affect our life, you know, there's always, I mean, you look at HOAs, those people are, they sound like they're a great thing for keeping the property value up, but it's really about your neighbor controlling the way you live.
Right. Right. You know, I think that's the dominant thing, is that people are unaware how our government works anymore, and that is largely by design. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't taught civics in school.
And then those of us that did get some of it, it was, you know, we needed a lot more.
Well, right. You know, we don't understand how these things actually operate. And when you're talking with your legislators, if you understand how the agencies operate, you're going to be able to help your legislature to understand how they operate as well, because particularly a lot of these freshmen and sophomore representatives at the state level really have no idea. And they're taught that the agencies in charge of whatever, that those are the experts. And they're not necessarily the experts. They're just the people who
signed
up and got the job.
Right.
You know? So you have to understand how the agencies work, and there are a few things that will be very helpful to people. If they can understand how agencies work, it goes like this. There's the federal equivalent, and all the federal agencies are sworn to harmonize and standardize all of our processes and all of our regulations globally. But at the state level, the state equivalent agency takes cooperative agreement money for an initiative of the federal agency. It's not even a law. It's just an initiative that the federal equivalent has. And the federal equivalent gives the state money. In our state, our budget is 2/3 federal funding.
Wow.
That's horrifying. You know? So if you can cut off part of that money chain, if you can work concertedly with your legislature to constrain the state equivalent's budgets, then we have a chance to really make an impact within our states.
But we also have to do this on a local level, because it does feed up the ladder.
And this
is where you can make some of the biggest difference. And you'd be surprised how much just showing up for your different meetings can affect how the outcome is.
It has a tremendous effect. Like, I don't know, the states vary, but counties, it goes like this. It's basically your city, your township, then your county, then your state, and then from state to federal. So that's like a very small redux on how that works. But if you show up at your township meetings, and if you show up at your county commissioner meetings or whatever your particular setup might be, in your city meetings, things of that nature, and just ask questions, they'll be like, wait a minute, what? Because all they're thinking about, for the most part, is we need money, and they're offering us money, so we'll take it.
Right, but there's strings attached, and there is a reinvention of government taking place. And that reinvention of government is going towards that administrative structure, as opposed to having our ability to vote and have control over our lives, right?
Right, absolutely. Now, this is kind of a funny little aside. My husband was on hold with the IRS a couple of years ago, and they were playing the Nutcracker Suite. He called them back later, and they were still playing the Nutcracker Suite, so evidently they knew what they were doing. But at any rate, it's the reinvention of government. That was Al Gore's statement, and that's where instead of being citizens, we're now customers and stakeholders. We're not
human
citizens.
Resources.
Right, we're resources. Even worse, we're human capital.
And so when you talk about your Council of Governments and you have your governors meeting with the Chinese in a national meeting in Utah, what have they got to do with all that? And yet...
this is part of the harmonization process. What happens is they're trying to get the states individually beholden to these international trade agreements, so that the state then has the legislative framework to harmonize everything internationally.
And, you know, interestingly enough, when I went to go look at our Colorado Revised Statutes, and I was just looking under election things, at the time, it's been several years now, but at the time I kept running into everything saying it was being harmonized, and I kept looking, well, harmonized to what? I couldn't find anything what it's saying it was being harmonized to.
And now you know. Yeah, in agriculture, there are three international level agencies that put forward guidelines and initiatives that are treated as law under the World Trade Organization. And those three international agencies are Codex Alimentarius, which is like the global FDA for food, the OIE, which is like the global USDA for animals, and the IPPC, which is the International Plant Protection Convention, like the global USDA for plants. And these three agencies set forth guidelines and initiatives to harmonize all treatment, care, growing, trading, everything in agriculture and in food.
And one of the things, I've interviewed some people that have been involved in some of this process, and one of the things people need to be aware of, these are not all-knowing people. I mean, they're sold a line of baloney just like the rest of us, and they will accept it and be passed off. A lot of experts are passed off as being experts when they've been sold an agenda, and they're just trying to sell it to the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. And you know, most of these people are just people. Very few of them understand actually what it is they're taking part in.
Right.
Okay, they're just told, this is your job, this is what we have to do, this is a new initiative. Don't question, don't think, you go do your job, right?
Right.
So, you know, the way to counter that is to question and to be very critical in your thinking, which sometimes talking to these people is...
I love your logic statement you stated on one of your interviews.
Well, that's the way it works.
But Ray Charles.
Yeah, it's God is love, love is blind, Ray Charles is blind, therefore Ray Charles is God. That's the type of reasoning that's employed here. It's like with the National Animal Identification System and with so many things, now we're supposed to give up our freedom because of fear. The whole push behind that is we might have some kind of a disease event. So if we enumerate everything, mark where everything is, and make everybody report within 24 hours if their cow jumped a fence, everything will be better.
We haven't found just about any other control factors. It has been very, very little anything to gain from it for all the effort that's been put out.
No, the only ones that gain from it are those who are supplying the technology. You know, it's always look at who benefits. You know, whenever a city has an idea that they're going to take some grant money, find out whom it's from. Most mm-hmm. of the time it's FEMA. And then if you look into FEMA, what does FEMA do? Once they get in there, they bring in a plethora of additional bureaucrats that suddenly raise your cost of living astronomically. And it brings in the International Property Maintenance Code.
Right. And we're coming down to a close of the program, so I want to say, Doreen, I hope we can do this again sometime.
We kind of went all over the board.
We sure did, but it does go all over the board. That's the whole thing, is that you find an area to pay attention to, and you'd be amazed at how much difference you can make, or at least getting the word out to people. And Doreen, give your website again.
Truthfarmer.blogspot.com or truthfarmer.wordpress. And you can read my articles on newswithviews.com or Liberty News Radio.
And again, I want to thank you for coming on the program, and people start looking into this, some of these issues, because, you know, when you start having the ability of somebody anonymous to say, you know, say you're abusing an animal when you don't have the ability to prove or it becomes very costly, then it's time to start looking at what's going on here.
Absolutely.
And I want to thank you again. And coming up next is John Sampson, and he's sitting in for Jane. This is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. So I will let him in here, and good night. Good morning. I'm used to night here.
All right. Bless you and thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye.